Mark Revisited, study number 25. The text, Mark 8, 22 to 33, and the title, At Last, the Blind See, or Do They? I'll read our section, which brings us to the end of Mark part 1. Mark 8, 22. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spat on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, Do you see anything? He looked up and said, I see people. They look like trees walking around. Once more Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home, saying, Don't even go into the village. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, Who do people say I am? They replied, Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. And still others, one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked. Who do you say I am? Peter answered, You are the Messiah. Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. Get behind me, Satan, he said. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. The dramatic section now before us completes part one of Mark's Gospel, following which I should like to pause briefly in our journey and offer some preliminary conclusions on Mark and his message. Following that, sufficient stamina being given to me and to my valued listeners, we'll press on toward the end and toward the goal. That is, in the words of the ancient litany, to thine agony and bloody sweat, to thy cross and passion, to thy precious death and burial, and to thy glorious resurrection. Our section begins with a miracle unlike any other told by Mark, the apparently fumbled healing of a blind man in Bethsaida. Cranfield comments, the reference to a second laying on of hands is unique in the recording miracles of Jesus. Hitherto, the mighty works of the Lord have been instantaneous and complete in their operation and final in their consequences. That is to say, an assurance is given of no return, as in 5:34, which is an important guarantee and pledge. Here, however, there is disappointment. Question, do you see anything? Answer, I see people, but they look like trees walking about. Hardly the success hoped for. It is, of course, a parable in a miracle, an omen of what is about to happen, as Peter at last sees who Jesus is, yet utterly fails to grasp the road Messiah must take in order to fulfill the scriptures and the purpose of his Father. Many of the older commentators fail to get the flow of the narrative here, and I think the reason is because they saw Mark as simply a chronicler, and not as what he is, a preacher with a message. On then to verses 27 to 30. Evidently it is examination time. Time to discover if the words and works of Jesus have led the 12 to the truth about their leader. The journey into the countryside is presumably in search of some peace. This is a momentous hour, and must not be disturbed by ever-pressing crowds. Question number one, who do people say that I am? Well, no secret about that. The answer is not difficult. Mark's readers, too, already know what ordinary folk have been saying for a while now, 6:14 to 16, and it is not, repeat not, that Jesus is merely a famous moral teacher. How often, incidentally, in his writing, C.S. Lewis makes this point. So what did the people think? That is, our Lord's contemporaries, the people around. The Baptist, roused from his grave, one solution. Elijah returned from heaven. Jeremiah, one of the great prophets, resurrected to give again his message. These are extraordinary verdicts by any measure, are they not? Pause a moment. What have these three men in common? One, all three are among the greatest names in Israel's history. Two, all three would be visitors from the heavenly world, from the presence of God, voices from beyond the grave. Three, all three in their time and generation found themselves in a life and death conflict with the corrupt religious establishment. It was these voices that the crowds were hearing again. Listen to Grand Old Jeremiah, quote, "Both prophet and priest are godless. Even in my temple I find their wickedness. Therefore their path will become slippery, they will be banished to darkness, and there they will fall. I will bring disaster upon them in the years they are punished, declares the Lord." It's recognizable, that, isn't it? As the voice of Jesus, too. And yet, despite these realizations and this reverence that the people had towards Jesus, this amazing awe, the people's verdict is nowhere near the truth. So now the searchlight focuses on the 12, with the great question, the second question, what about you? What is your verdict? You've been with me for so long now, what do you say? What is so impressive about Peter's confession is that he found it impossible to fit Jesus alongside the names being talked of amongst the crowds. Even to say that a great prophet had visited God's people was somehow wholly incommensurate with what he knew of his teacher and master. And then by God's grace the truth dawned. Jesus was not a prophet of Israel at all. He was the one all the prophets had been pointing to, the one who was to come. Here, in flesh and blood, was the hope of Israel, and as we know, the hope of the world. This confession, then, is the culmination of Mark Part 1. The truth about Jesus is out, affirmed, and professed. So let me now tie up a few loose ends by calling to my aid the late Alan Stibbs, one-time vice principal of Oak Hill, and a very fine teacher of Mark's Gospel. When Alan reached 8:31, quote, "Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer," he loved to speak about Lesson 1 and Lesson 2, that is, the two great themes of this Gospel. Stibbs made just two points that deserve far more consideration than I can now give them. Point 1, Jesus does not begin Lesson 2, that is, 8:31 and onwards, until Lesson 1 is thoroughly understood. Presumably that's good technique for primary school teachers anywhere and everywhere. So that's point one. Jesus does not begin Lesson 2 about the suffering of Christ until Lesson 1 is understood. Point two, Lesson 1, having been completed and taken in, we must charitably assume that it is taken in, Lesson 2 is urgently needed in order to avoid misconceptions. I repeat, Lesson 1 having been completed and taken in, Lesson 2 is urgently needed in order to avoid misconceptions. I take point 2 first, since it explains verse 30, when directly after Peter's confession, Jesus warned his disciples not to tell anyone about it and about him. This is simple common sense, since the public's expectations of Messiah were entirely erroneous and wrong-headed, as indeed were those of the 12. Jesus has been firmly disavowing the notion of a triumphant Messiah bringing freedom from Israel's oppressors, peace and prosperity to the people. And now, with the three prophecies of the Passion, misunderstanding will be no longer possible. As Mark says in verse 32, Jesus spoke of these future trials very plainly. And Peter, well, he reacts in horror. No, no, he says, no, that cannot possibly be Messiah's destiny. This famous confrontation with Peter we must leave for Mark Part 2. But it's now sufficiently clear why Lesson 2 must begin immediately. It will be an extensive lesson and a painful one for everybody. Only when lesson two is clearly understood can public proclamation of the coming of Messiah be possible. In my student days, there was much strange theorizing about the messianic secret. But really, there's no mystery at all about verse 30. As yet, the future apostles have no gospel message to give to the world. There is so much now to learn, both in terms of message and ministry. So much for lesson two. I repeat, lesson one having been completed and taken in, lesson two is urgently necessary in order to avoid dangerous misconceptions. Now for point one, a la Mr. Stibbs. Jesus does not begin lesson two, Mark 8:31 onwards, until lesson one is understood. In my recent experience, it's essential to spell this out. It may have been obvious to an older generation, but not now. I take time and trouble to elucidate this point. In broad terms, the importance of what Jesus said and did, and the significance of what people said and did to him, depends entirely upon who he is. That is what Mark is telling us. If Jesus is but one of many religious teachers the world has known, what he taught, how he died, his legacy for mankind, is of only comparative importance. Whereas if he is, by his own testimony before the high priest, Mark 14:61-62, the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One, sitting at God's right hand, coming on the clouds of heaven, then, as Mark's mentor, the Apostle Peter, once said to the Jewish council, salvation can be found in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given to mankind by which we must be saved. Professor James Atkinson wrote as follows, quote, "The single word cross becomes a synonym and designation for the way of atonement God had chosen to reconcile lost man to himself." Again, quote, "To Paul, the word cross meant the saving gospel. It was the touchstone of his message and mission." Now, that's fine, it's truly said. Yet I think Mark would want to remind us that he did not preach the cross, nor could the cross be understood until he had first preached Christ as Lord. Just so, Paul too preached Christ and him crucified. The person had to come before the work, if the work was to be understood. When Karl Barth was asked for a definition of the Christian message, I imagine an answer of massive sophistication was expected. Famously, he replied, according to the children's hymn, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." Yes, indeed, but much depends upon who this Jesus is. The wonder, as Paul said, is that the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. A fine or rather absurd illustration, for which I do not apologize, what matters is getting our message home, reminds us just how serious it is to ignore the fact that he who gave himself for us is both our Creator and Judge. I was addressing a group whose attention was fitful. Off the cuff, I imagined two schoolboys creeping unwillingly or willingly to school. In the common parlance of such occasions, one put his tongue out at the other to receive a friendly shove by way of reply. However, on arriving at school assembly, a similar greeting to the headmaster produced a much less amiable response, as you might imagine. "For many years," I said to the group, "I've worked in the City of London, where it was normal for perfectly intelligent people, in effect, to stick their tongue out against their maker and judge, and without a thought. The name of God's Son was a useful expletive. The God squad was easily mocked. An invitation to hear the Christian message was seldom received with any urgency. The Church of Christ was part of the furniture to be exploited when needed. The suffering of the innocent, a sufficient reason to give no thought for Christ's sacrifice. And there, but for the grace of God, goes all of us. How very serious is this common blindness, and how foolish." So, my brothers, here the great question we're commissioned to ask is this: but what about you? What do you say? Who do you say that Jesus is?